Tiki Barber retired at the end of last season when many believed he was still at the top of his game. His statistics as a running back for the New York Giants were quite impressive, including being the franchise's all-time rushing and reception leader. Now he's moved into broadcasting, which includes being a correspondent for NBC's Today Show, and he joins me now to talk about his new memoir, Tiki, which is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm very pleased to welcome him to the show. Hello.
Hello, how are you doing? Thanks for having me.
You certainly began your new career with a splash. Was it written into your contract that you had to be as outspoken as possible?
It wasn't written in, but that's just how I am. I think as I have grown up and had experiences, being truthful in your job is the most important thing that you can be. And I got a lot of flack as a football player for often saying what everybody else was thinking but wouldn't say.
Well, some coaches actually, not just in football, but in all sports, insist that their players not speak mm-hmm. to the press or only speak to the press when somebody is there to make sure that they don't get off message.
You know, it's funny. Wally Matthews, who writes for one of the New York papers, wrote this article right around my retirement in the last season. He said, we still, for some reason, have this plantation mentality with our athletes where we expect them just to say yes, sir, or no, sir, and we're going to go try our hardest. And that's just not something that's acceptable to me because I grew up knowing or being told what I could do, what my limitations were, what my abilities were. And my mother would always counter it by saying, you can be whoever you want to be. You believe in yourself, you make your own decisions, and you stand up and fight for what you have to say. And that's how I became. Now, there was a line that I had to stay on. You know, I couldn't undermine my team. I couldn't throw us under the bus. But at that same time, when I felt things needed to be expressed, I did it, and I don't regret it.
Well, you're a lot more supportive of Eli Manning in the book than you were in that statement. So your thinking has changed since?
No, you know, it's not. It's, and it gets misconstrued a lot of times. And I always caution people against reading something or hearing it secondhand and making a decision based on someone else's opinion. Make your own opinion. When talking about Eli Manning, I essentially was relaying a story, a personal experience with him, which is what my job is on Football Night in America, to give an opinion and give a truthful and honest one based on what I experienced. And as a young quarterback, Eli didn't have a strong voice. He's very soft-spoken. He's very reserved. And we were trying to force him to be this leader, to stand up and make himself feel accountable. And it was funny him trying to do it. And that's all I was saying. It wasn't anything derogatory, demeaning towards him as a player or as a leader, just that everybody goes through these growing pains, and it's funny.
And if anything, maybe what you said has spurred him to become more of a leader. In both the book and the interview you gave to your NBC colleague, Matt mm-hmm. Lauer, you said that you might have continued playing if not for Coach Tom Coughlin. Was it personal? I mean, you played with a number of coaches over the years.
It wasn't anything personal. It was a hypothetical question. The way it's worded in the book, it says, it's worded like this. So there it was. Maybe if Tom Coughlin wasn't my head coach, I'd still be playing. And that got blown out to be, oh, if Tom Coughlin was fired, he'd still be on the team. If he wasn't the coach, Tiki would still have this passion for the game. And, you know, there's a lot of other factors. People want black and white. People want the simple answer. But life isn't like that. It's a complex mix of things that go into making every decision in your life, including whether or not to retire from myself.
There are coaches who inspire some players and not others. Yeah. I remember that Eli's brother didn't want to come to the Jets because of a coach who many people mm-hmm. consider somewhere near God.
Yeah, you're right. You know, it's different strokes for different folks. And I don't fault Tom Coughlin for the way that he coaches. In fact, some people relish in that kind of environment, but it wasn't for me. As a 10-year veteran, I didn't enjoy being treated the way that he treats players. And that's my problem. And that's why I decided, one of the reasons I decided to walk away.
Would you have liked to play for someone like Bill Belichick, who seems to think that you can do whatever you want as long as you get a win?
Winning at all costs? I don't think that's the right message to send. But, you know, in our league, it's $4 billion business. Winning is really the thing that matters. I don't know if I'd have liked playing for Coach Belichick.
But when you're winning, it does make it a lot easier,
doesn't it?
Winning
makes things, it cures all ills. And in fact, some of the things that go on that become headline news otherwise would go unnoticed if you're winning.
You say in your book that some coaches and players read business books like Good to Great by Jim Collins. And we're seeing more and more books from coaches that are aimed at the business and the business motivational market. So is football becoming more similar to other businesses?
I think football is a metaphor for all things in life, in particular businesses, because of the immediacy. The things that you need to be successful in a business, the teamwork and the perseverance, and when quarters go badly, you figure out a way to rebound and come back. You see all that stuff in sport, and you see it in an immediate fashion. And I think CEOs and otherwise look for those examples in sports for their own worth and for their own well-being.
But aren't some former players lost when they find themselves having to contend with the real world?
A little bit, you know.
Because all their lives they've been coddled, taken along. Somebody carried their bags.
You're right. You're God's gift, and then all of a sudden someone else becomes God's gift, and you're insignificant. And I think it's a responsibility for players to start looking at the future, even right when you get to this job, because it could end. You could walk down the stairs and break your ankle, and then what? What are you going to do with your life? And
well, you had a serious injury in your rookie season. Did you start thinking about what might happen?
About a year later, I did. I tore my posterior cruciate ligament in my right knee, and I was not the same player that I was coming out of college or my first five games. And I had to readjust. I had to reinvent myself. And more importantly, I had to start looking for other things in my life to fulfill me. And fortunately, I recovered and became a great player. But I had this parallel path going in broadcasting and in journalism that I've fell in love with.
And you've been doing a radio show with your brother over the years.
Yeah, it's been fun.
That was preparation for this?
A little bit, but that's just fun. It's a private conversation that people are privy to. Me and Rondé talk about myriad of things, from sports to what's going on with our families to our opinions on other things and going on in the world. So it's fun.
You're unlike other football players, the two of you, in another way. You both stay with the same team throughout your careers.
Yeah, that's very rare. And I was very blessed to do it, and so was Rondé. And, we sacrificed a little bit probably in the free agent market, but I think it was worth it. My first running back coach with the New York Giants told me, nobody loves you like your mother. And, I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, you go somewhere else, they won't love you as much as we did when you first came here.
But when you first came here, you didn't want to be in New York.
No, I wasn't a big fan of New York.
And then you made more of you fell in love with the city.
I did. My wife wanted to live here, my girlfriend at the time. And by a blessing, I got drafted here, and it kind of worked out. We got married, and she wanted to live in the city, so I fought a battle that I didn't fight that battle because I knew I wouldn't win. So we moved in, and within 2 weeks, 3 weeks, I knew this was the place for me. The energy of it, the opportunities, the vibe never goes away, and it invigorates me.
You say in your book that some NFL players have difficulty making a distinction between proper behavior on and off the field. Is that because of the violence involved in the sport, or because athletes are so venerated in our society that they've been made to feel like they can do no wrong?
I think it's more of that. I think we see too often our star athletes in high school and college, they get the free pass. They don't have an accountability to those around them, and much less themselves. And so they feel invincible. It's almost like, oh, I can get behind the wheel of a car completely inebriated, and nothing's going to happen to me. I'm a football player. I got to be on the field on Sunday.
Well, this woman wants me.
Well, exactly, and whether or not it's in your mind, you think that of course somebody wants me because everybody is always wanting me.
Well, it seems to me from reading the book that the way you escaped that was your mother.
My mother was definitely the reason why I stayed grounded, because she challenged us in ways that didn't involve sports per se, and we were always compelled to have friends outside of sports. I lived in the city, as you know, for my 10 years here in the NFL, and most of my friends were not my teammates. They were guys that I met in my building or
well, your teammates choose to live outside of the city.
They live in Jersey. They're not taking advantage of what this city offers. But I did take advantage of it. And friends of my wife's that she met at classes or at work, they became my friends, and it kept me grounded away from the pressures and the expectations and the keeping up with the Joneses of the NFL.
My guest is Tiki Barber. He's written a memoir called My Life in the Game and Beyond. It is written with the help of Gil Reville, and it is published by, who published this book?
Simon & Schuster.
Simon & Schuster, yeah. A pretty big publisher.
Yeah.
Your father had been a football player, but you didn't know him much,
No,
did you?
not very much. My mother and father were divorced when we were four, but he was out of the house much earlier than that. And he came back into our lives once when we were in about seventh grade and another time right before we graduated from college. And we knew we were going into the NFL, and it was weird. It was awkward. Because of the lack of emotion that I felt, high or low. I was kind of indifferent in the middle, and that scares me, actually.
And yet you went to the same school he went to, UVA.
No, I went to UVA. He went to Virginia Tech. Both my parents went to Virginia Tech, and one of the reasons we did go to the rival was because we didn't want to follow in my father's footsteps, and it was our silent kind of way of rebelling. And and still to this day, I don't know how I should approach my father. And it's a conflict. You know, people who in New York City, they get obsessed with the Giants and what my opinion is and what my torment is. My torment is much deeper than what's going on with the New York Giants. It's personal. And that's what I try to get across in this book.
Did he ever try to?
Oh, yes, he has in many ways. And I saw him briefly at a Dallas Cowboy game about 6-7 years ago. He had his son there, his new, and I have a step son and a stepdaughter, not step, a half brother and a half sister, who I really don't know. And it's interesting. My father is a preacher now, a minister, and I know his life is right, but for some reason, I still struggle with how to approach that relationship.
Well, you did have a close relationship with your brother. Identical twins always do.
Yeah.
Your names are. Your real names are from are Swahili?
Swahili. My mother and father knew an exchange student at Virginia Tech, and we were premature babies. Ronde was born first, 7 minutes before me, so his name, Jamel Oronde, means firstborn son. My name, Atim Kiambu, derives from the fact that in the incubators I was wild, just ripping the tubes out and screaming my head off. It means fiery-tempered king. Fiery-tempered king. I gave it to my son, actually, AJ. He's a team junior because at times he can be fiery-tempered.
What was it like being twins, both playing sports? Did you, first of all, when you were kids, did you imagine that you would go all the way to being professionals?
You know, we had tons of different dreams and aspirations, and football was one of them just because we were good at it. It gave us an opportunity to go to college and get a great education at the University of Virginia. But by no means did we know, you know, without a doubt that we were going to be football stars. It just happened. We just happened to develop in the right way, in the right method.
Well, you obviously took your education seriously, unlike some athletes.
No, I knew it was more important. You know, the unfortunate thing in the NFL is that most of the guys went to school for free, meaning the most valuable thing you can have in your life is your education. And only 23 or so percent of us in the NFL have a college degree, which is depressing in some ways, because when the game is over, what appreciable thing can you do with your life?
Now, you'd always played together, and now suddenly you're on different teams.
Yeah.
And he plays defense. He's a quarterback. You're a running back. What happened when he had to tackle you?
It was tough. You know,
did he say, sorry, bro?
No, actually, he was vicious. It was a couple of years ago, we played down in Tampa Bay, and I was getting tackled. I was going out of bounds, and he comes up and just throws an elbow right under my chin. And I got up. I was like, what is wrong with you? I mean, I was going down already. He goes, I had to make it look good. And so, you know, he understands his job and my job, but there's also that little rivalry that people want to see. So it was kind of cool.
Well, we see that in every sport when there have been basketball players, twins, who played against each other. And they'd elbow each other.
You have to, and you don't take it personal. You just it's kind of what you did your whole life, but no one else was watching. Now people get a chance to watch it.
In the early days of your career, you had a serious problem with fumbleitis.
Yeah.
In fact, they called you Fumbleia.
Yeah.
Why is that? Because you hadn't fumbled a lot in college.
No, you know what? It was more of it was two things. It was the increased contact in the NFL and the vicious contact in the NFL, but also a lack of awareness. I was always worried about being balanced, and I would use my arms to balance myself. And as we got a new coaching staff, they came in and said, Tiki, you have some of the strongest legs on our team. Run with your legs, balance with your legs, and keep the ball high and tight across your chest. And literally that one little coaching tweak changed my career and made me and allowed me to become an elite back.
But you also wound up in some hole in the wall gym in Paterson, New Jersey.
Yeah, exactly. You can't forget the Joe Carini who drilled a mentality in my head. You know, also he was, you know, he's one of these world's strongest men, so he did the pull in the truck and those type of things, those functional exercises that build real strength and not just gym strength. But it was more the mentality that he had. You know, I would get under a squat rack with 1,000 pounds. And I'd tell myself, there's no way I can do this. But Joe's insistence and his yelling and his encouragement convinced me that I could do it if I just did the movement and put my mind to it. And that carried over to the football field. When we'd go up against a team where I knew the linebacker was great or the defense was great, I would convince myself that I could be successful. And it worked.
Because that's what athletes have to do. Boxers have to convince themselves, even if they're going up against the greatest boxer in the world.
You're absolutely right.
They're going to win.
This punch isn't going to hurt, and I'm going to stand up there and take it and win.
You begin your book with a detailed description of a specific run. Yeah. Why did you choose that one?
You know, he just wanted to do something unique and get inside of what I experienced. And it was so fun.
It's like having the camera on
your
helmet.
Exactly. It was so fun sitting down with Gil and describing this. We watched the run from start to finish, every step. It's called 42 Steps, about what I was thinking, what I saw at every point of the way on this spectacular run that I had against the Kansas City Chiefs in 2005. And if you like football and you can visualize, you really feel like you're running. That you're missing a tackle, you're making a guy miss or breaking a tackle or jumping over a guy and walking into the end zone. It's pretty neat.
You had an incredible sense of balance. It's the only way you could do that because you have to keep on shifting your weight.
You know what it is? It's body awareness. This is a funny argument because a lot of kids now are specializing in sports. If they want to play basketball, that's all they do all year long. If they want to play baseball, that's all they do. Football, they work out all year long. But I think my lack of specialization as a young kid, I wrestled when I didn't make the basketball team, gave me a sense of who I was as an athlete. And I used those other skills that I learned in other sports, ultimately in my profession as a football player. And I would encourage kids, you know what? Do everything because you never know what you're going to pick up.
Soccer would really help.
Soccer would be great, mainly for the conditioning, but also for the foot control and balance.
What do you think about the criticism that's leveled at football, that it's too violent and encourages a culture that worships violence?
Yeah.
And the New York, I'm going to add to this because we don't have a lot of time.
Yeah.
The Times had an article the other day about how kids play with concussions.
I saw it on Saturday.
They're afraid to tell their coaches that they're hurt.
Front page story, the New York Times. And it is a little bit scary, and I worry about my kids if they want to get into football because they're obsessed with it because Daddy and Uncle Rondé play football. And I don't want them to have that mentality that I had. I played with a messed up knee. I played with a broken ulna in my left arm. I played with a broken thumb because of the mentality of I have to play. I'm going to tough through it, even if it's detrimental for me down the road. And football is dangerous like that, but I think it's important. This is where coaching comes in. At a young age, when they're learning the game, they have to learn how to be smart because these things can really be detrimental to your life, not just your health, but your life.
Players who come out of retirement often say that they miss the contact. I always understood what that meant.
I don't know if I'd ever miss the contact. That's one of the reasons I got out of it. But I think contact with the other players, your teammates, that's special. And the bond that you form with a team like that is hard to find anywhere else.
Now, we don't have the time to go into some of the other things here, including some of the non-football things. Your story about Debbie Reynolds, which is really fun,
cool.
and your meeting with Shimon Peres.
Very great.
But obviously, one happened before you became a famous player. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that football has opened up all sorts of opportunities to you. You've met people you never could have met otherwise.
I really have, and that's been the special thing about living in New York and having an awareness of what my status as a player could do for me and taking advantage of it.
Although Debbie Reynolds was in Roanoke, Virginia.
Yeah, she was in Roanoke, Virginia, and I didn't even know who she was. She was Princess Leia's mother.
T. Tiki Barber's memoir, Tiki, is published by Simon & Schuster, written with the help of Gil Reville. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.